Okay, welcome everyone to another Tuesday afternoon here in America and Tuesday evening in Scotland, Ireland, where this is going to be played at sometime, either next Tuesday or the week after, whatever the case happens to be. I am Stephen Roberts. This is Cancel the Cabal. I got introduced to a whistleblower through a few other people in some Facebook groups. I'm going to ask you if you want to reveal who some of these people are, but I do want to welcome David Riley to the show. And David is a, I'm going to let him explain what his biography is and what he's done in his life. So welcome to the show, David.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Credentials, as I tell my students, I teach in the business department at this local university. Credentials-wise, I'm retired. I'm a former CEO of a worldwide billion-dollar corporation, very successful. So I've had contact with people around the world basically all of my career. I'm also a retired CPA. I program computers, do networking, teach programming, networking, web design, everything to do with computers. Programmed my first computer in 1962, and that should tell you how old I am. As far as other credentials are concerned, I have taught at the university level at least 65 different disciplines, psychology, philosophy, English. So I have a wide and varied background that way. I also worked for a short time period helping some people out of the state of Washington in doing venture capital. And that is basically how I got involved with some of the corruption that occurred down in Panama. So there's my background a little bit about what I am and what I am not. And one thing again that I tell the students when I start my first classes, my name is Dave. So you can call me Dave.
Okay.
Don't call me Mr. Rowley, because that makes it too formal. Okay. So with that having been said, where do you want me to start on this?
Well, I do want to say before we get started, I normally do forget, but sometimes I don't, that all of the stations are listener supported. So if you like what we're doing, hit that donate button. I'm on PayPal and, gonna soon get Patreon, but your past and the people that you dealt with are the kind of people I'm looking to seek for venture capitalism to make some money off of what I'm doing.
Okay, now, I'm afraid that my contacts going back 30 years ago are probably not around anymore.
I see, yeah,
but that doesn't mean that the same avenues can't be used.
Correct, but well, you mentioned in the phone call we had last week that you were in the South American, the Panamanian area, weren't you?
Panama itself.
Okay, yeah. Well, let's just go back to the beginning of how that happened to be.
Okay, the people I was working for at the time were out of Seattle, and I was managing a company for them. And during the process of several years with them, they came to rely on me for a lot of their financial input. And they finally sold this business that I was managing for them and decided they wanted to go into some ventures of their own, one of which was they purchased the rights to a cobalt and gold mine in Nevada. And found out that it was too expensive to transport the ore by truck or rail to the nearest smelters. So they wanted to build their own smelters. And to do that, they needed about $25 million. Pretty good chunk of money in the 1980s, first part of the 80s. And so they contacted me and asked me if I could help them raise that kind of venture capital. So I started making some phone calls round and about. I wound up with a gentleman out of Vancouver, British Columbia. And you said something earlier about names. And to protect people, there will be a few names that I'll mention, some that I won't, if that's all right.
Yeah, sure, absolutely.
Okay, because this gentleman was a gentleman, and he was involved with doing some underwriting, some securities out of a company out of Denver, and his line, if you will, took him to the Republic of Panama. When I contacted him, he had just made contact with a group in Panama that had all the credentials and had all the papers and paperwork and all of the proof that they were raising capital for people.
Excuse me, Dave, what time frame is this?
This is 1989.
Okay.
I made contact with this Vancouver in September of 1989. The company that he had contact with was Morgan Gundy International. And if anybody knows their securities, they'll recognize that it's a combination of two very well-respected firms, Wood Gundy and Morgan Stanley, and they've just taken a couple of respected names, put them together, and created their own company down there in Panama. But they had what appeared to be the credentials necessary to put forth a underwriting for an IPO. So I made arrangements and made the trip down to Panama City, arriving there on November 10th of 1989. After spending a day getting oriented, a gentleman from Morgan Gundy came over to the Marriott Caesar Palace Hotel and took me over to meet with them the next day. I subsequently spent the better part of the next 7 days going back and forth and back and forth. And every time I'd go, they'd want another piece of paper and another piece of paper. And then they needed some upfront money to defray costs because it was getting expensive. And I contacted my people in Seattle and told them what was going on. And they said, yeah, but we need to build this, so we'll send them down some money. And they would send down $3,000-$4,000 in a shot over the course of the next 7 days. At the end of that 7 days, my visa time was up, so I returned to the United States. About 2 weeks later, and several faxed documents and letters back and forth with Morgan Gundy, it was determined that they needed more money. And so the people in Seattle decided to send me back down there again. I tried to talk them out of it, but they were paying me, so I went down there. I arrived that second trip on December 10th of 89 and immediately went to see Morgan Gundy, and immediately they were asking for additional monies. I wouldn't give it to them. They stalled for a while, and then finally they made direct contact with people in Seattle, who then wired them the money they were asking for. So I was obligated to kind of stay there and make sure that the paperwork was going through properly, that we were getting to the underwriters, that we were going to get approval from the CNV, the Comisión Nacional de Valores, which is the equivalent of our SEC. And I happened to be there on December 16th, I believe it was, the day that Manuel Noriega declared war on the United States. And I still have somewhere a copy of the front page of the newspaper where he did his declaration of war. That caused quite a bit of unrest with the U.S. citizens there, myself included. So I made arrangements to leave Panama, but everybody else decided to do the same thing. And the first flight out I could get was for December 20th. So I hold up, if you will, at the Marriott Hotel. But on a Sunday morning, I decided that I was tired of being holed up in the hotel and I wanted to at least go to the outskirts of the city. I rented a car And I started driving according to the maps and the information I'd been given by the hospitality at the hotel. And I wound up down on Calle Este in downtown Panama. While going down Calle Este, I noticed some people looking at me kind of funny. And then after a while, people started shaking their fist at me as I would go by. And then at the end of the street, I saw a bunch of PDF, Panamanian Defense Forces, blocking the street. And I decided that I was in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Uh-huh.
And on off to my left, I saw an alleyway. And I decided my best bet was to get out of here. So I turned and went down the alleyway, and PDF chasing me and yelling and the whole schmear. I finally got out and wound up clear over at Howard Air Force Base in Fort Clayton over on the American side of the canal. And everything was empty. There was nobody anywhere. I started driving up one of the streets past a row of churches. And the churches were empty. This was a Sunday. Finally, I saw a Baptist church that had one car in front of it. And I pulled in there, went in to ask what was going on. And those people were so surprised to see me. They could not understand why I was there. I said, "Don't you know that we're under echo?" And I said, "I don't know what echo means." He says, "It means that we're at war with Panama. And all of our troops are getting prepared for war. And there are no services. There's nothing here. You better get yourself back to the hotel and stay put." I did. I worked some back roads and got back and stayed put. Now, the reason I bring up the Calle Este is that during the same day that I was going down Calle Este, there was another car that went down there about an hour before I did that had in it some military personnel and wives. And one of the young military people was shot and killed at that particular spot, which was the final catalyst that brought about the invasion of the U.S. going into Panama. It was not a safe environment. The people who did the killing and the shooting were called Dignity Battalion. And let me point out real quick, when they say Dignity Battalion, they had no dignity. They were young thugs. If you want to equate them to today, they were the Antifa, the Black Lives Matter. They didn't care who they beat up, who they killed, who they looted, what personal property they destroyed. They were paid by Manuel Noriega and his group to create destruction and havoc and then blame it on other people. Well, I got back to the Marriott Hotel and I stayed put till the night of the 19th, at which time the manager of the hotel called 10 of us, who he called his best residents. He better, I was staying there paying him a lot of money for a month at a time. But we went up to the 15th floor to the restaurant up there and had a dinner at his expense, wherein he made the announcement that the Marriott Hotel was extremely proud of its security and the safety of its guests, and that regardless of what was going on politically, there would be no problem. We were all safe and not to worry about it. That was the night of December 19th. I went to my room, which was on the 15th floor, at about 11 o'clock at night. Went to bed at 12:46 a.m. And I'll never forget the time because I was woken by bombs going off in downtown Panama City. And I rolled over in bed, and there's that red digital clock that said 12:46.
Right.
I got up, ran to the window to see what the heck was going on, and I watched bombs being dropped on and exploding in the Comandancia area of downtown Panama, which is about 5 miles away. I watched as a stealth bomber went over my head. Wasn't supposed to be there. Nobody knew about those. I watched it go. There were two of them down there that were operable, as I understand it.
Those didn't come off for another two years after that, 1991.
No, this is 19th of December, 1989.
Correct.
Oh, yeah, I know what you're saying. I'm sorry.
Correct. They didn't come into anyone's view until 91, the first Gulf War. Yeah.
You're correct. But they were there in 1989. And by the way, I have a book that was presented to me by Rochelle Constante, who I'll get into her a little bit later. But in that book, they have photographs of that stealth bomber going overhead in Panama City in 1989. So believe your government how you want to, but they don't tell you what's going on all the time.
No, right.
I watched those bombs drop, and I looked down into the parking lot of the hotel, and I saw six PDF soldiers with automatic weapons coming across the area. Now, anybody who's ever traveled to a foreign country, or at least at that time, realized that when you go into the registration, you have to give them not only your nationality, but you have to give them proof of your nationality. So they know who you are. They know your country. I realized that all that had to happen was for the PDF to go to the front desk and demand to know where all the Americans were being kept, and I would be one of them. So I quickly pulled on some clothes and headed for the door, opened the door, and had an AK-47 shoved in my forehead. Why were they there so quickly? I found out later that the people from Morgan Gundy had already alerted people who I was, where I was, and how to find me, and they were in the building before the drums were mopped, and they were just dropped, and they were just waiting for us. So I was asked to please step into the hallway, and I said, sure, why not? And I stepped into the hallway, and the captain put his sidearm into my side, and the guy with the AK put that against the base of my skull in the back, and they said, who else is on this floor? And I said, I don't know. I don't know anybody. And they said, we're going to give you one more time. Who else is on this floor? And I said, I can't tell you. And he says, this is your last chance. If you don't tell us who's in these other rooms, we're going to kill you. I looked at him and shrugged his shoulders. I said, then you're going to have to kill me because I don't know. He hesitated for a minute, cocked his gun, hesitated for another minute, and then said, down the hallway. So they started shoving me down the hallway to where the stairs were. We got to the stairs. By the way, the reason they wanted to know who was in the 15th floor, I didn't know it at the time, but it turns out that's where the CIA operatives all stayed when they came to Panama.
So correct. Yeah.
That's who they were after.
Yeah.
We got to the stairwell, and this captain told me, down you go. We're going clear all the way down, 15 flights. I took one step, and he put his hand in my back and shoved me. And he did that at every landing. I went down 15 flights of stairs, rolling down steel steps all the way down. When I got to the bottom, my knee was messed up. It still is to this day, but yeah, it got messed up, and then
I just had an interesting question come up, Dave.
Sure.
Mentioned that this corporation that you work for, Morgan, what?
No, the underwriters that we were going to go down and get to underwrite the stock was Morgan Gundy.
Okay. I just wonder if Morgan Gundy was a, what do they call that, shell corporation for the CIA?
Oh, you're good. I've got to give you that. I was going to get that. We'll jump around. I have no problem with
this. No. Go ahead and continue.
You're absolutely so on target. It's not even funny. You've been doing this for a while.
Yes, I have.
Morgan Gundy, it turned out, I'll jump ahead and then come back a little bit. After we escaped from being held hostage, I returned to the United States, and 3 weeks later, I returned. Took my 12-year-old son with me, which was, you know, kind of brazen, but whatever. When I returned, then I found out that Morgan Gundy was a laundering arm for Manuel Noriega. And while it was not in the terms that we think of it in the world of finance and business as a shell company, it was still a shell company.
Sure.
I mean, it had employees, it had an office, it had building, and it took in money, but it still did nothing. So does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Well, I mean, all of the shell companies on all of the secretive agencies all over the world do the same thing. You know, they just funnel whatever they want to through that shell corporation.
Correct. And as another side note to this, Manuel Noriega, as I'm sure you're aware, was actually put in power and propped up in power and used by the CIA when George Bush the first, George W., I guess he is, was the director of the CIA.
Herbert Walker, so, H.W.
Pardon?
Herbert Walker, H.W. W.H.W.
Oh, so he was H.W.? Yeah.
Yes.
The first president?
Yes.
Okay. He was the person who basically put Manuel Noriega into power and then made sure that he stayed in power, and the CIA through him, or him through the CIA, funneled millions of dollars to Noriega, which gave him what he needed power-wise and influence-wise to be able to control the republic. Now, Noriega initially was not the president of Panama, nor was he a general. But he went up through the ranks a little at a time with help from the United States government, and was a, quote, intelligence gathering arm for the U.S., which I presume, with no direct proof, I presume was the CIA, because they were the ones that were down there so heavy, and they were the ones who had put him in power. And his means of gathering intelligence were extremely ruthless. You talk about corruption in politics. His was corruption with the use of fear, and it was physical fear. The PDF would attack and beat up anybody that he wanted them to. They didn't care. The Dignity Battalion, his little thugs, he armed them. They went around and beat people's heads in, broke bones. They do stupid things like shoot out the streetlights so people couldn't travel at night or be on the streets at night without fear of being mugged. He did mental abuse too, threats, and as well as brutality. While I was in Noriega's home after the, or during the hostage taking, I saw the room where he'd take his mistresses after he got tired of them. There was no more interest to him. And there was an altar in there where he would behead them. And I don't want to get too graphic here because I don't know your audience, but there were drains in the floor. Let's put it that way.
Sure.
Financially, he would control through financing, he overreaching taxes, confiscation of their property, economically through his drug pipeline. If you didn't do what he wanted and help him with the drugs, then you could lose not only your livelihood and your family, but your life. This was his means of controlling the populace. It's totally 100% corrupt, and it was illegal based upon even Panamanian laws. And I say even Panamanian laws, their laws are as good as ours. But he did one other thing in his controlling too. He was very nationalistic in what he did. He preached, oh, we'll get rid of these taxes. We'll help you with this. We'll take care of this problem for you. Just make sure that when you go to these fraudulent elections, that I'm voted back in. I won't have to worry about it. And I'll do all these things for you. And then he never would. He just, you know, it was all total lies and deception, which should sound very familiar to people the last year.
Sure. Absolutely.
It's the exact same scenario. As a matter of fact, in this book I was telling you about, there's about four short paragraphs in there that I was reading to my wife yesterday, that while it's describing Noriega and Panama at the time, it describes the United States and our situation starting 1 year ago. And it gets worse. So it's history repeating itself, only this time in the United States, not in Panama. So, you know, people who don't know their history are destined to repeat it, right?
Yes.
We're repeating it. And the last way that I can remember that he controlled was through religion. Noriega claimed to be a Christian, and he claimed to be a Muslim, and he claimed to be a Jew, and he claimed to be a Buddhist. And while I was in his home, keep in mind, this was at Christmas time. This was December 20th. Well, actually, it was December 22nd, I guess it was, that I actually wound up in his home. And in his back room, his patio area, he had a Christmas tree decorated with all the trappings of Christmas. He had voodoo dolls sitting in front of that Christmas tree. He had red underwear off to the side of it because that was supposed to ward off evil spirits according to Satanism. And he had a Buddha there. He had everything for every religion in there, making sure that he covered his bases. But he could go to any place and claim that he was their religion and that he had been told that this is what they needed to do for him and for Panama through this nationalistic fervor that he would meet up and deal up and create. So he had his ways of controlling, and his ways were propped up by and supported by the United States government. There's no question of it.
That sounds a lot like Canada's Justin Trudeau. He panders to every group that they have up there in Canada.
Yeah, I wasn't going to name names, but okay.
I don't pull any punches.
Go ahead.
No, we don't pull any punches. This is the internet.
Oh, okay. Well, I just don't want people coming after me and wanting to beat me up or something. You know, I got over that a long time ago. What the heck? But fear was his biggest factor. Fear through all of these areas was how he did his work. His money laundering was done with help from the United States. It was done through Morgan Gundy. He ran drugs from South America to Miami and Houston. And it was set up as a pipeline, according to the people that I had in Panama and some of the books that I was given down there. He was doing it with the help of and for the CIA. So it was U.S. government that was involved in Noriega extremely heavy. He was a CIA puppet.
Yes.
There's no question of that.
Yes.
The CNV, their SEC, was headed by a gentleman, Eric Tahadahim. And Eric, in my dealings with him, tried to do everything he could to just stall my underwriting every chance he got. But after the invasion and we got with him, he started becoming a little bit more candid because he was no longer being protected by Manuel Noriega, and he admitted that he and the CNV were nothing more than a shill for Noriega to do what he wanted to do, to rob from the people and rob from the tourists, and especially North Americans, and take their money. And if you'll remind me as we get into this a little bit, I will explain how the United States became extremely complicit in that one.
Well, that
go ahead. That
just segues me into a statement I totally forgot to even mention to you last week and at the beginning of the show. I don't call them government anymore. I don't make that mistake. Any government, our government or any country's government, I don't call them government. I call them what they are, criminals and criminal activity is what it is.
Well, I call them criminal enterprises, so I...
Yeah. Same thing.
Okay. So instead of calling them a government here today, should I call them CEs?
Absolutely, if you want to. Sure. Criminal element, criminal cartels, whatever the case.
You'll find out that I have a very, very dry sense of humor and don't take things too seriously anymore.
I do, too.
This business in Panama. Because after I landed down at the bottom of those stairs and was drunk to my feet, I was taken over to the, where the elevator shafts were, and there were 11 other people. They were seated down at the elevator shafts with their knees to their chests and their arms laced behind their head. And there was about six PDF there with automatic weapons on them, telling them to not go anywhere, be quiet. They were taken out of the Marriott Hotel itself. And this is where the lies start. Out of the 12 of us that were taken there, seven were from the media. The media immediately tried to, in my opinion, commit treason. Okay. They said, oh, you're justified in what you're doing. Please let us get to a phone and we let us call your story in, and it will be all over the media in the United States, and it will have our stamp on it because we are the media. The people of the United States will believe whatever we have to say, and we can promote your cause and help you out. And it will make the United States look like terrorists. And they repeated that several times. And finally, PDF weren't stupid. They said, okay, sure, why not? So they took two of them. They took them down to the telephones in the mezzanine level and let them call their story in and do just exactly that. Of course, part of the agreement was that the reporters were supposed to be let go. All of us were supposed to be let go. Well, after it was called in, why, surprise, surprise, those two military or reporters were brought back by the military back to the elevator shafts and made to sit down with their knees and their hands, and Panamanians got what they wanted and the reporters got nothing. After about 15 minutes of in that position, the word came from somewhere and the PDF got us up and rushed us outside into two waiting Land Rovers and drove us very quickly through the dark streets of Panama over to one of Noriega's homes. And there we were put in his laundry room. It was a big laundry room. It held us very nicely. So down one side there were some of the hostages, a couple across the back, and the rest of us across the other side. And at the front of the entrance to the laundry room were two soldiers with their automatic weapons. And we were there only about 10 minutes. And mind you, most Panamanians speak English, so this is how done mostly in English. But the two Panamanians told us they wanted some identification from us. So everybody started digging in their wallets and started pulling out driver's licenses or whatever. All I had on me was my passport. They took that and left with it. About half an hour later, they came back and gave it all back to us. And so we asked them, what was the purpose in that? And he says, we went down and made copies of it, showed them to the people at the United States Embassy that we had hostages, American hostages, and that if for some reason they were able to capture Noriega and did not release him to them, that we would be shot and our bodies would be dumped on the doorstep of the U.S. Embassy as proof that they would continue to do it until Noriega was released. The response from the U.S. Embassy was, collateral damage. We were worth nothing at that point. We stayed there in that position, wondering now what's going to happen to us. For about 3 hours, the phones kept going off in the other rooms, and the captain kept going and answering them back and forth. And finally, after one of them, he came back in and told us to get up. We were going to go outside, and we were going to be executed. Well, you got to know me in order to understand what happens next. But I'm a very different individual. My children say I'm weird, and that's okay. And sometimes they say I'm strange, and that's not okay. But I was weird. I immediately stood up and started outside. And a Panamanian officer stopped me, and he says, are you in a hurry to die or something? And I turned to him. I said, no, but if you will promise me that you will call my wife and tell her that I lived for 3 extra minutes just for her, I'll wait 3 minutes.
Right.
He stared at me and fell on his knees in the middle of all of us and started to cry like a baby. And he said, I do not understand it. I've been trained by Israelis and Cubans to kill without mercy. But I can't do it.
Ah, there's another key I was going to okay. segue into.
No, go ahead.
Well, the Israelis have taught countless countries, militaries and police forces how to do those types of things. And the Israelis learned them from the British and the Americans and the Russians.
Well, absolutely. As a matter of fact, we had in Panama, we had a school down there and moved from Panama eventually to Houston, where we trained foreign troops in military tactics and in terrorism tactics. And that was going on during this time period. Now, that... my documentation on that is in this book called The Enemy Within, Casting Out Panama's Demon. So I didn't see it myself. But he felt that he was supposed to be able to kill me and everybody else in there without mercy. And
well, he
just couldn't.
He probably also thought that you were supposed to beg for your life, too.
Well, now that might be. I hadn't thought of it from that standpoint. Because that is part of the terrorist situation, isn't it?
Psychological imprinting and psychological warfare.
Well, I hadn't thought of that. That's a new thought to me. I'm going to have to put that in my repertoire. Because when he said that, I looked at him and asked him that. He said, of course I'm not going to. And I said, well, then let's go and get this over with. And I took one more step towards the door and he says, stop. And the soldiers that were guarding us initially stepped in front of me and stopped. And he looked around at the others who were in the laundry room. And he says, I can't do it. Can't do it. He stood up and he said to all of them, he says, get up. Get out of here while you still can. Well, we got up and started for the door. I stayed where I was, right in front of him, in sight of him. Everybody else ran for the door. And then they stopped. They didn't know where they were. Our heads had been down all the way over there. And so I turned to the captain and I said, you know, you brought us here. I think you should take us back. He looked at me and he said, you are the strangest man I ever met in my entire life. And I says, oh, that's good. And he turned to those other two with the weapons and he says, load them up in the Land Rovers and take them back to the Marriott. We went outside. Seven of the of us got in the one Land Rover. I was not one of those. They got in one of the Land Rovers, and that one took them straight to the Marriott, dropped them off, and they were fine and safe. The other Land Rover that I was in had two members of the press, one from the New York Times and one from Reuters. And then the rest of us were civilians. One of the people was a Greek who had arrived from Greece that morning to take a new job in Panama. And he spent his first day being a hostage. Wonderful. But in that Land Rover, they started to take us back and we're going down Main Street. Nobody on it. But on the side, you could see Dignity Battalion watching us go by. And suddenly, one of the reporters... and this is where I have no problem with the name, because this man almost got us killed. And then later he took credit for reporting truth. Let's put it that way.
Right.
But he yelled at the driver up there and said, hurry it, man, hurry it. We're being followed. And that driver scared the heck out of him. He slammed on his brakes and ordered us all out of the Land Rover and onto the streets where the Dignity Battalion was. And Mr. Lindsey Grusin of the New York Times almost got us killed that night.
Well,
we went over. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I'm not sure what your knowledge base is or what your knowledge of history is, but it's my belief that the CIA basically created the American media today. They have infiltrated ever since 1948, right after they became the CIA after the OSS. They started infiltrating news medias through Project Mockingbird or Operation Mockingbird. I guess it's both really the same thing, whatever you want to call it. But they had the I think it was the church congressional meetings back in the 70s that actually expose this. They carefully place with Rothschild money, Rothschild and Rockefeller money, their CIA agents in the media, and they have been for the better part of 70 plus years.
They're still there.
Still there, yes.
Mainstream media is still owned by the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers and the Collins and the Astors and the Clintons and
the Morgans.
The Morgans, yeah. No question of it. That's and you, when you say no history, that is history. That's not speculation. That's history that's been proven.
Yes, it is. Every bit of information that comes through any media outlet, and also any of the world's agencies, whether it's the Mossad or the CIA or the KGB, all of it gets funneled through Reuters and AP, and then it gets distributed out to wherever it's supposed to go, with its little left or right hand spin.
Well, that would bear out what came next then, because myself and one other person in our little group that was dumped in the streets, went over to an apartment complex. Now, in Panama in those days, because of the Dignity Battalion and Noriega, they had iron gates and iron doors around, grated doors around the glass and the entrance to the apartment buildings and businesses and so forth. And we went up to this iron door and reached through it and pounded on the door. We wanted to get out of being exposed on the streets. Nothing. So I pounded again about three times. Finally, somebody appeared, took one look at us and started waving his hands. No, no. And started shouting, go away, go away. And then he disappeared. So we went back, got the rest of the group, and hid behind some gorse bushes along the side of the road, not knowing exactly what to do. Because on the other side of the street, we could see the Dignity Battalion getting agitated. And they were starting to make motion about coming over to where we were at, trying to find us, I guess. And so I'm not one to sit and do nothing. I don't believe in words. I believe in actions. And so I took off and went back to that apartment building and pounded on it again. And after about three times, here comes this guard for the apartment complex, starts waving no, and I held up my U.S. passport to him. He looked at it for a second. Finally, he opened the door and the gate, and he says, come in, come in. I says, there's more of us out here, five in total. He says, get them in here and do it in a hurry. So I went and got them, and we went in there. He ushered us back to the elevator shafts, the outside of it, went down into the parking garage and told us to stay there, be quiet, and in the morning we could find a way to get out of there. We went back and dutifully did as we were told, except Reuters news agency, and I don't know his name, and New York Times, Lindsey Grusin, decided they needed to start talking and get their stories straight.
Yes.
And that's words they used. And they started making up things that absolutely did not happen. One of the things they talked about, Lindsey said, here's one that'll get the Americans and get them agitated. He says, we can tell them that while we were there at the Marriott Hotel, that the Panamanians made me open my mouth. And they stuck the barrel of an AK-47 in my mouth. And then in tune with the ice falling in the ice maker, they would make the sounds of a machine gun going off. And I turned to him and I says, that did not happen. And I will never forget what he told me at that time. He looked at me and he said, shut up. We make the news the way we want the news to be. Right or wrong makes no difference. We're the press. Therefore, what we say is what the people will believe because we have credibility and it is in writing.
That's right.
If you are to contradict us at any time, you will become the bad person in this whole thing and we will destroy you.
That's right.
That's our power.
Well, it was William Randolph Hearst in 1897 that told all of his benefactors or the people that wanted the war, when the U.S. Marine was blown up in Havana Harbor, of course, he said, "You provide the images, and I will give you the war."
I've heard that before. I didn't know that it was Randolph Hearst, but that wouldn't surprise me at all. The Hearst newspapers were the most powerful at the time, weren't they?
Yes, they were.
Well, that's almost a direct correlation to this, then, isn't it? And vice versa, because that's what I was told. At that point, I knew they were right. I didn't say anything more, and they continued to put their story together. One of the stories that they had out there was that there were mass graves being dug in Alto del Golf, in the old abandoned golf course over there, and that there were 500 Panamanians that were rolled into that with bulldozers, and then they were buried over in Alto del Golf. Now, there were some areas where there were some mass graves, 10 or 15 people dumped into them. People that they could not identify had no identification on them, and yes, they were buried with bulldozers. That part's no question. But not 500 and not in Alto del Golf. And certainly not by the time these, dare I say, idiots were making up their story. They didn't know anything about that. They came up with that story, and it later got out on CNN News and became the truth.
Yeah, yes.
Now, during that process, these two were talking loudly, and somebody on the top floor, it was a seven-story apartment complex, somebody on the top floor shouted down the elevator shaft and said, "Shut up, no English." They didn't want to be compromised, and Lindsey Grusin yelled back and says, "We'll do what we want." Now, if you want to get people killed, there's a second chance you've got to get us killed, you know, being an idiot. Sometime during the night, the security guard for the apartment complex, his last name was Noriega, by the way, and he would not take any connection to Manuel.
Yeah, right.
His name was Jose Noriega. He came down and said, "I've got a place that you can go and stay for the rest of the night, and you can even make a phone call to the Marriott Hotel and get somebody to come get you." So he took us up to the third floor to an apartment, and the lady in there and her two daughters took us in and gave us a little bit to drink and eat and whatever, and the phone. And with the phone, Lindsey and his cohort called the Marriott Hotel and made arrangements for someone there, one of their friends, to come and pick us up. And when the car arrived, Lindsey said, turned to us and says, "Well, there's room for two of us. We'll send the car back for the rest of you." Yeah. That's the last we ever heard from him, directly at least. But while we were waiting, Mr. Grusin and Mr. Reuters decided they wanted to call their stories in to their chiefs. So Grusin was calling New York City and Reuters was calling England on Brenda's phone. And they racked up enormous long-distance charges on her phone. And when they left, they didn't even offer to pay her a thing for it. They just left. They were gone. That was the end of it.
Right, right.
Well, a quick jump ahead. When we finally got out of there, I gave her $1,000. That's the funny thing. While we were over there and they were searching us in Noriega's laundry room, I had $7,000 on me in $1,000 bills. They didn't take it. They saw it, but they didn't take it. I don't know what their thought was. But anyway, when we left out of there, I gave her $1,000. It was the smallest bill I had to pay for her phone calls for New York Times and Reuters, as well as myself and the others that were with me in the apartment complex. Because Brenda did, and we asked permission, she did let the other two make phone calls home. Two of the people were civilian contractors for the military, and they were there under the guidance of the auspices of Senator Jesse Helms, a Democrat senator from Georgia.
Yes.
And they called him and talked with him, and he made promises to get us out of there. He'd get us out. That never materialized either. But they made several phone calls to him, and I made one phone call home to my wife to let her know that I was alive and well. I don't remember how long the phone call lasted, maybe 2 or 3 minutes at the most. And I wouldn't misuse her phone after that. So when we left, she probably had phone bills of somewhere around $150, $200 all told. So she got taken care of.
Sure.
That's an aside, but it also tells you the mentality and the arrogance of the media as they do their thing.
Absolutely.
We were in her home for 3 days, bullets flying around us. The Dignity Battalion would come and shoot up the apartment complexes, do their thing. We'd have to hide, hoping that nobody would find us. I got tired of that after the first day, and so when everybody else was running back into the back bedrooms and hiding in closets, which I thought was ridiculous, you know, that's the first place they're going to look. I'd sit out there at the front table with Brenda, and she taught me a little bit of Spanish over the next few days. I can order a French fries and a hamburger and a chocolate shake and pizza in Spanish now.
Right.
Well, at least I can get food. But I was sitting there one morning with her, 6 o'clock in the morning, and we heard noises, loud, loud noises outside the window. And up the street came a tank with an ATV behind it. And the tank turned when it was about half a block from us. And in about 2 minutes, that tank blew in the front door of Noriega's home. And Delta Force, that was not supposed to exist at that time, but the Delta Force went in and secured the home and took captive two of Noriega's bodyguards. Of course, they didn't get Noriega. He was already over at the Vatican Embassy. But they took his two bodyguards. With them there, let me back up just a little bit. While I was in Brenda's home, one of the things that was happening, Grusin and his Reuters people and the rest of the media portrayed the Panamanians as hating the Americans, not wanting us there, get us out of there, the whole bit. But while we were there, the Dignity Battalion started coming up the street, house to house, searching for us because they knew we had escaped. They knew because they had caught the captain that was supposed to have kept us guarded, found out that he'd let us go, and they killed him and went hunting for us. As they would go into a home and then leave, the minute they left, the occupants of that home would call Brenda because they knew where we were. And they would tell Brenda, the Dignity Battalion just left my home and they're on their way to this home. And when they would leave the next home, that home would call. And the next home would call until the Dignity Battalion would be right across the street. And when that happened, then a gentleman from the seventh floor of the apartment complex would appear at our door, and he took us up to his apartment on the seventh floor, and we'd go out onto the roof, lean over the balcony, and watch the Dignity Battalion come across and enter the apartment complex. And this gentleman from the seventh floor would get phone calls as they left the first floor, as they went through the second floor. When they'd leave Brenda's floor, she would call them, and then he would take us down the back stairs, the fire escape, I guess, down and back into Brenda's home on the third floor. And the Dignity Battalion would search the rest of the complex, find nothing, and leave. Now, these people, Stephen, that supposedly hated our guts, risked their lives several times to save ours. That was not told to the American people. As a matter of fact, the opposite was told to the American people.
Sure.
Okay, enough of that.
Well,
we got to a point that we knew that nobody was coming to get us out of there. And so we started watching it. When that tank blew Noriega's door off, we figured, okay, we've got some American forces in the area. At one point, one of these contractors got, his name was Jim, he got so agitated at staying there and so worried that we were going to be shot at again that he finally sneaked out of the front door and went down and around to Noriega's home and convinced some of the soldiers there that they needed to come and get us. The soldiers were not happy about that, but they came over there and they wouldn't come into the apartment complex. They didn't know if it was a trap or not. But when they were over there, that's when we left Brenda's. We thanked her, paid her, and left. We went across the street and these soldiers took us around to Noriega's home. Now, when we entered Noriega's home, the soldiers that were there doing mop up and looking at documents and so forth, for some reason that to this day I do not know, thought that I was from military intelligence. And they started handing me documents. What do you make of this? What do you think of this? What's this paper doing? And I'd look at them. Oh, I don't know. I have no idea. Finally, the major that was in charge of the group came up from the back and he looked at me and says, who are you? I says, I'm one of the hostages. Oh, well, come with me. And he took me into the back. And we were seated back in that back room where this Christmas tree was and all these statues I told you about earlier were. I've even got pictures of that. But after being there for a short time period and visiting with the major, he told me, he says, would you like to go and see the rest of Noriega's home with me? I said, sure. That's when he took me to the room where I told you about the mistress, their demise.
Yes.
But we went upstairs into Noriega's upstairs where he had a complete casino up there, roulette, crap tables, you name it. And then we went into his bedroom. And in the bedroom, this major started searching and going through all the desk drawers and the rest of them. So I went over and started going through the dresser drawers. And that's when I found $5 million in cash. The major got a box. We boxed up that $5 million in cash, U.S. cash, and marked it and sealed it. Later on, we were getting out of there. The U.S. Air Force sent some helicopters in from Howard Air Force Base, and we went out into Alto del Golf, which is why I know there were no mass graves, because it was still pretty pristine, and boarded these helicopters and flew from there over to Howard. And I joke and I tell people when I tell them the story of this thing that I had the most expensive footstool ever because I had to sit on a little bench and put my feet up on $5 million in cash as we transported it. my backdrop was two bodyguards of Manuel Noriega. We got over to Howard and everybody unloaded and a colonel appeared. And that colonel took charge of the $5 million cash and disappeared with it. Okay. I'll get back to him in just a minute, I suppose.
Well, I wanted to add something, if I could.
Go ahead.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier that the Panamanian Defensive Forces, they were looking for CIA personnel in the hotel, correct?
In the 15th floor.
Well, the reason they were doing that, you also mentioned something else here a minute ago, but that kind of slipped my mind. But every country that ever goes into panic mode like they did down in there, they are always looking for the CIA because the CIA always caused trouble, and they have for 70 plus years. If they do happen to find somebody that is CIA, they have some sort of leverage over the Americans.
See, I'm learning more new things all the time. I didn't realize it. I knew the CIA caused trouble for everybody, and that might be why they searched for them, but I didn't think about the leverage thought. That's why they wanted the hostages from the 15th floor.
That's right. Yep.
Okay, now it makes perfect sense now. Well, the leverage, they missed the boat because I said I'd get back to this colonel later. I'll do it now. I was there for a short time period at Howard, and finally, through a lot of begging, if you will, I finally caught a ride on a C-130 manned by the Texas Air National Guard out of San Antonio. And on our way back, 15 hours, I sat there with some lady's two-year-old kid sitting on my knee. And, well, two-year-old kids don't hold it too well for 15 hours. But we got home, and to their credit, the Texas National Guard got me a flight on American Airlines, and no cost to me. I still don't know who paid for it. I assume they did. But then I got flown home. There was intrigue in that as well. Maybe I'll get into it, maybe I won't. But after I got home, 3 weeks later, I was assured that everything in Panama had quieted down. My people in Seattle wanted me to go back and try and finish this underwriting. So I went back again the middle of January.
Oh, goodness.
3 weeks later. Took my 12-year-old son with me. He wanted to go.
Right, right.
So while we were down there, the first night there, we went to dinner at the in the basement of the Marriott Hotel. And I had a gentleman approach me, and he said that he was with the FBI. And I said, oh, okay. He says, we're looking into the happenings down here, the hostage taking, because that's kidnapping and the whole bit. And of course, the FBI has no jurisdiction in Panama, but whatever. And I said, okay, what do you want from me? We visited for a little while. He says, you know, I've got 50 agents here. And those 50 agents, we have done a lot of research. And it seems that there was a box of cash taken out of Noriega's home, and that you're the one that took the cash. And I says, well, in a way, yes. And so I told him the story. And he says, so do you know the colonel's name? And I says, no. He says, I will get back to you. The next night, he came back to me. He says, we found the colonel. He says, we asked him about that box of cash that was given to him. And he says, oh, yeah, there was a box given to me. I'd forgotten all about it. I can get it for you. And he said, well, we'll go with you. So they went with him over to his home or his quarters, whatever. And I'll be darned, that box was sitting in the back corner of his closet behind all of his clothes.
Right, right.
I forgot about that. Well, here it is. So right there, they opened it up and counted it. It was $3.5 million, not $5 million. $1.5 million had disappeared out of that box that he knew nothing about. Now, am I making accusations? No, I am not. I'm simply pointing out facts. Then this FBI agent told me they had the $3.5 million. 2 weeks later, another FBI agent wanted to know that story. I told him. He says, oh, no, the FBI never got any of that money. Nobody ever saw that money.
Yes.
So I think that the Panamanians went after the wrong group, maybe go after the CIA, but I think they maybe should have looked at the FBI in the process.
Well, funny little tidbit people can keep in mind. I can decode some of their phrases and stuff. You know, they have this phrase called national security.
Correct? Oh yes,
yes. Well, that is only a coded phrase for we messed up and we have to cover it up now. But we've actually gone over an hour here, Dave. If we can wrap it up here, no, I mean it's okay if we can wrap it up here. And I know,
well,
maybe
another time you want me to go through all of the corruption that happened with the stock exchange, with Morgan Gundy, with
yes,
all of those people. That takes about another hour.
Yes, we can do that.
Okay, you let me know when. Let me just point out, as far as corruption is concerned here, right quick, that everything that happened down there to us as hostages and all of the garbage that took place was instigated by, supported by, and caused by corrupt government officials in the United States government. I still have letters from the Department of Treasury and from the Secretary of State telling me that it was safe to go down to Panama, that there was no problem, and that everything was good, and our relationships were good. And this was 4 days prior to Noriega declaring war.
Yeah.
So well, maybe someday.
There's no coincidences. Not when these people are. There's no coincidences when these people are involved.
No, none whatsoever. So if you decide you want me to, I'm at your disposal. I will do it.
Yes, we can do that. I know what your schedule is now.
Okay.
So thank you once again, David, for coming on. Dave.
Well, hey, I appreciate it very, very much. Thank you.
All right. We'll talk soon.